Disrespect introduces Dr. Paul Byrne, a neonatologist and the past president of the Catholic Medical Association of the United States, who has 30 years' experience both in practice and in research on the subject of brain death. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's probably to begin with, we should explain how a neonatologist gets involved with the issues of brain death and organ transplants. Well, in 1975, an infant in our nursery had been on the ventilator for about 6 weeks, and he wouldn't move and he wouldn't do anything, he wouldn't breathe, and so a brainwave test was done. His brainwave test was flat, and it was interpreted as consistent with cerebral death. The test was repeated, and it was unchanged, and then the question came up about continuing treatment, and I said, of course we're going to continue to treat him, although there was some suggestion that maybe that could get stopped. But we continued to treat him, and eventually he got off the ventilator.
Oh.
Eventually he went to school.
Really?
He got straight A's. He ran track. He played baseball.
Oh.
He's an adult now. He's married, has three children. He works as a paramedic. But he was the patient that started my study of brain death. When the report came on his chart, said essentially flat brain waves, and then the words were there, consistent with cerebral death.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the word death on his chart, and I knew him, and I knew that there was something incompatible here.
Right.
And I didn't understand this thing called cerebral death.
Right.
And I continued to treat Joseph. Eventually, I started to study the issue of brain death, only to find out that it has had many different meanings then.
Yes.
It has many different meanings now, but all of the meanings amount to somehow declaring someone legally brain dead while their heart's beating, and they got blood pressure, and they put out urine, and if you cut on them, they move and squirm unless they're paralyzed.
All right.
And all of that is done to get beating hearts and other organs for transplantation.
Right.
It's been made legal throughout the United States. It's legal in some way or another in Canada, although it's difficult to determine if they have a statute in Canada. A number of years ago, they tried to get one, but my understanding was that they couldn't come to agreement, so they don't have a flat statute, but they still get organs in Canada. And
who opposed
brain death was just made up to get beating hearts and other organs for transplantation.
Who opposed the statute in Canada, do you know?
You know, I don't know where it is. I looked for it not too long ago. Couldn't come to any firm conclusion. In the United States, the first article on brain death was published in 1968.
Right.
Between 68 and 78, there were 30 different sets of criteria published.
Okay.
And there are many more sets since that time.
Right.
And the way they get around it in the United States is that they say this declaration of brain death is made in accordance with accepted medical standards.
Oh.
And they make it accepted medical standards, and then the standards is plural, and so there are many different standards that make it accepted, so that there isn't any one set of criteria that's used in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect it's the same in Canada, but maybe they didn't get to where they wrote it out exactly the same. Here in the United States, it's called the Uniform Determination of Death Act.
Okay.
And in the United States, the way the government was originally set up was that each state was to have its own laws.
Oh,
and for the most part, it's that way. But the Uniform Law Commissioners got involved first with making the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, which is the law that they get organs. They did that first in 1968. And then, but they have revised that law in 2006, and it's already been passed in 40 states, which makes it that everyone, it's presumed that everyone intends to be an organ donor. It's presumed that everyone has consented to every test to be done to them to determine if their organs are suitable for transplantation.
Right.
It's determined that everyone has agreed that they can continue to do things to the donor to keep their organs suitable.
Right.
Originally, the law was made that to be an organ donor, you had to be of sound mind. They've stricken that from the law.
Right.
So that no longer do you have to be of sound mind. Originally, you had to be 18 to be an organ donor. They reduced that age down to 16, 15 and a half in some states, and there are some states 14.
All right.
But they can sign up to be an organ donor.
Right.
And the laws, the evolution of the laws are all made to get more organs. Here in the United States, when you go to get a driver's license, they ask you, do you want to be an organ donor?
Yeah, and you said you'd had an experience of that.
Well, I did. And she asked, do you want to be an organ donor? And I said, no. And then she said, do you have a living will? And I said, no. And then she asked, do you want to donate a dollar to the Second Chance Fund? And having taken many exams in my life, if the answer to two questions is no, the odds are the third one's going to be no. So I said, no. And now I said to her, well, tell me, what is this Second Chance Fund? And she said, that's to educate people like you so you'll become an organ donor.
I see.
Now, the significant things that ought to be known is that do you want to be an organ donor? And if you say yes, that gets recorded on the driver's license. But if you say no, that does not get recorded on the driver's license. So it's all set up to get organs. The revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act makes it so that a person can refuse to be an organ donor, but then, for the most part, there's no place to record that.
I see.
We have a Life Guardian Foundation, and we supply medical cards that basically people can sign and witness and basically says that you want to live the lifespan given to you by God.
Yeah.
And you direct your treatments and care to protect and preserve your life.
Yeah.
And it says do not do an apnea test, which is part of declaring somebody brain dead, and do not take any organs for transplantation or any other purpose.
Huh.
The thing that also people should realize is that when they get any kind of permission to get organs for transplantation, the permission is also automatically given so that the organs can be used for research or education.
Oh, okay.
So
you can be killed for academic purposes, in effect.
Yes.
And, okay.
And all of the documents that I've seen, everyone has been such that these things are all lumped together. They're not separated.
Yeah.
Here in the United States, basically there's a right that a patient has to have informed consent for a procedure. The only exception for that is if it's a true emergency, that kind of thing, then people can go ahead and move under those circumstances. But otherwise, you have to be completely informed. When you go to the driver's bureau to ask the question, do you want to be an organ donor? When the people say yes or say no to that, they have little or no information.
Right.
For the most part, even those who should be informed have little or no information.
Right.
You know, for the most part, physicians are not well informed.
Right.
Clergy are not well informed. And certainly lay people are not well informed.
So there's nowhere to go to for advice, even. Is that right?
To what, Jeff?
There's no one to go to for advice, even. You can't go to your physician. You can't go to your clergy.
There isn't any way. Everything is geared toward telling you about how to be an organ donor and then showing you the good effect of organ transplantation. They don't show you anything else. And, of course, if you're going to be informed about a surgical procedure, the law requires that you be fully and explicitly informed
right.
about the procedure, about the complications, about what to expect in the future. And,
yeah.
and people are answering these questions. Do you want to be an organ donor without being informed? And you know, with very little information, certainly they, for the most part, are not fully and explicitly informed. I believe that all potential donors, if they want to call themselves that, all potential recipients, which basically amounts to everyone, I suppose, ought to be fully and explicitly informed as to what these things are all about. In the case of heart transplantation, it's always a beating heart that's cut out. The surgeon either stops the beating heart or cuts it out while it's still beating.
Right.
But it's always a beating heart. And anyone who would say that such a person is truly dead, you really have to question their ability to make any kind of judgment. You could ask probably any 7-year-old, show them a patient in an intensive care unit and with the heart beating and blood pressure and normal temperature, normal color, and compare that to a corpse in a wake or a funeral home.
Yeah.
And a 7-year-old could readily tell the difference between being alive and being dead. And yet we are being told that this thing called brain death is such that you could cut organs out, and the ones who are in most jeopardy are the people who are between 16 and 30, because anybody who is past 30, or not too many years past that, knows that you aren't as good as you were when you were younger. 16 to 30 is when the organs are the strongest and in the greatest shape, and so... And of course, they'll take organs from people at any age. But the people who are at most jeopardy are the ones that are 16 to 30, because those people at that age are the ones that they really would like to get their organs, because that's when they're the healthiest.
My understanding is that quality of life comes into the picture, too, that people who are disabled are at greater risk because their life is judged to be of poorer quality.
Yes. Well, whenever I hear that term, I try to understand what people are saying.
Right.
And is it their quality of their life that they're concerned about, or is it the quality of their lifestyle?
Yep.
Anytime people bring up about the quality of life, I always ask myself, are they talking about their lifestyle, or their quality of life? Really, the way that I learned the meaning of the quality of life back when I went to college and took philosophy courses is that the quality of life had to do with the specialness of the person, really the likeness to God.
Oh.
And that's where quality of life meant. And the other things had to do with the lifestyle, and oftentimes that's really what people are talking about. For instance, I know some good friends who play golf 5 times a week.
Right.
And that's their lifestyle. And I suspect if you told them they could only play golf once a week, they would think that they were greatly impaired, because their quality of life was interfered with, when in fact it's their lifestyle. And
so when we talk of quality of life, we talk of the ability to what? I'm just trying to imagine what you've encapsulated in their likeness to God, the ability to give and receive joy, their moral qualities, what?
Right. Those kinds of things, but always our quality of life is that we are all special creatures. A creature
right.
is a good word to use, because it means created, the
okay.
Product of creation. And so it's okay to use. It's not a degrading term. The people who are in jeopardy so far as their so-called quality of life or lifestyle or whatever it is, the ones who are in the greatest jeopardy are those who are unconscious or comatose. At that minute, they can't do anything for themselves. They're completely dependent on the people around them.
I recall a case of a British man recently for whom attendants were called and the ambulance arrived, and the attendants went up to his place where he lived and saw that it was messy and decided that he didn't enjoy life, and so there really was no point in reviving him, and he died.
Yes, those kinds of things. Say, now, when I went to medical school and graduated from medical school, there were none of these questions. We were so happy if we had a patient to see,
yeah.
And then we were happy if we had a patient that we could make a diagnosis on.
Right.
And then we were really thrilled if we had a treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in modern medicine, many patients can be diagnosed who years ago could not be diagnosed, and many patients can be treated. And modern medicine is very exciting. On the other hand, when the patients that get in jeopardy are the ones that they can't make a diagnosis, or they can't make a diagnosis that they can treat. And then so quickly they want to stop the treatment. And so brain death was really made up to get beating hearts and other vital organs for transplantation.
And now a short break. If you like, you can consider quality of life and identity with Watermelon Slim, the way I am.
I wished I was down on some blue bayou, bamboo cane stuck in the sand. But the road I'm on, it don't seem to go there. And I just dream and keep on being the way I am. I wish I enjoyed what makes my living. Do what I do with a willing hand. Some would run, but that ain't like me. And I just dream and keep on being the way I am. The way I am don't fit my shackles. The way I am reality, I can almost see that barroom dancing. And I just dream and keep on being the way I am.
before the break and after, you're listening to Dr. Paul Byrne, past president of the Catholic Medical Association of the United States, a neonatologist with 30 years of experience in research into brain death, talk about the meaning of living wills, organ transplants, and brain death.
It isn't just that diagnosis that's out there. The words persistent vegetative state, again, were just words made up to describe a situation where they were predicting that a patient wasn't going to come out of that state.
All right.
Yet statistically, many of them get better, and then they continue to investigate some of these, and they've come up more recently with the term minimally conscious.
Yeah.
Well, all of these terms are part of living persons: minimally conscious, persistent vegetative state, brain death. Those are all persons who are living. None of them are dead. And in modern times, they get into the question about, well, how much money should be spent on somebody?
Yeah, they do, especially in Canada, where it's government money. Very
yes.
much.
Now, and Canada, the focus there because of socialized medicine. But remember, it's government money, but it's really it's the money of the Canadian people.
Yep.
Who give it to the government in the form of taxes, and allows the government to decide who gets treatment or who doesn't, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's different in the United States, and yet it is somewhat the same, because the whether you have the government taking the tax or whether somebody does work and an employer keeps a certain amount to purchase an insurance policy, the insurance policies are made in such a way that money is spent for some things and not for other things.
Right.
Granted, it's not across the board like it is in Canada, but the issues I think are very similar.
It still comes from a common pool, whether it's the insurance company's money from the policyholders or whether it's the tax money from the from the citizens.
Right. The question is, who's going to get treated? And if people ask me things about living wills, I get very concerned about living wills, because in some ways living wills are like life insurance. Living will has the word living in it. Life insurance has the word life in it. But life insurance has nothing to do with life. It only has to do with death.
It's like anatomic
life insurance, is so it can be sold.
It's like anatomical gift. When they intend to take something from you, they call it a gift.
Yes, right. And the so-called gift in organ transplantation, they call it gift, but they're taking it from somebody.
Right.
And there are these things that we get exposed to, but living wills all have to do with somebody getting less treatment. And once the person themselves have documented that they want less treatment, even if it's under certain conditions, they have documented that they want less treatment. And if they become dead in the process, at least in the United States, the doctors in the hospital are protected against liability if they have executed the living will. So these things are out there. They're words. What I encourage people to do is to focus on the word life.
Mm-hmm.
And know that our life is a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And know that what doctors and nurses do,
mm-hmm,
is we protect and preserve life. And that's all we do. And if ever anything is asked, and I teach this to medical students and residents and nurses, if you're asked to do anything to a patient that's not going to protect and preserve their life, get away from it, because it's not medicine. The only thing we do in medicine is protect and preserve life. That's all we do. And if we can't do that, it might be that the patient is so sick that we don't know what to do.
Yeah.
It might be the patient is so sick that the patient will die. But even when the patient dies, what we still do to the best of our ability is to protect and preserve the life that's there. But we don't do anything to hasten death or shorten life. We don't do anything to harm the patient. At least we do our best not to harm the patient. Everything we do in medicine has side effect, and so it's always possible that something could happen, but it ought not be the intention of the physician or the nurse to harm the patient. Our only intention ought to be to protect and preserve the life of the patient. And that holds true whether we're talking about the unborn baby or the newly born baby or the teenager or the a person who is 80, 90 years old or whatever that is. Whenever people talk about the elderly, I always ask them, how old do you mean?
Yeah.
They always mean something older than them.
They do, don't they?
I looked up elderly in the dictionary once, and what it said was beyond middle age.
Right.
So really anybody past 35 or 40 could be considered elderly if somebody wanted to do that.
It sounds like you're advocating against having a living will, given that it seems that it can only restrict your options for medical care. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Right.
What does
I haven't seen any living wills do anything for people. Now these cards that we give out, and people can look them up, or they can contact LifeGuardianFoundation.org and get these medical cards. And the medical card gives instruction that you want to be treated. You don't want anybody to shorten your life, and you don't want anybody to take your vital organs.
Right.
And the cards are such that they can be signed and witnessed by two witnesses.
Wow.
And you can designate someone to see that you get treated in this way.
Okay.
The cards will not allow anyone to stop your treatment. They will only allow someone to continue the treatment.
Okay. Yeah, sounds very worthwhile. So other than this step of forbidding the stopping of your life, which seems rational enough, what other steps could someone who's suddenly faced with this decision, what other steps could they take? It sounds to me as if the only step that they can, with a conscience, take from your point of view is steps that would preserve or restore the life of person they're in charge of.
For the most part, no one has to worry about getting too much treatment. Because if the treatments are such that they're not effective, they will be stopped. Don't be concerned about that.
Yeah.
And that will prove probably whether you're in Canada or the United States.
Yep.
You don't have to worry about being treated too much or too long. That's not going to happen.
I think a lot of people do.
You don't have to worry about living on Earth forever. You won't.
No.
No one will live on Earth forever.
Right.
And so all we want to do is to live the length of time that we get to live, and if we get sick, we want to go to the doctor and feel confident that the only thing the doctor's going to do is to protect and preserve our life in the very best way he knows how. And we ought not be concerned. I mean, right now, if someone has a head injury and they're unconscious and they're between 16 and 30, they're going to get very good treatment.
Oh,
the
really?
Question is the treatment to save their life or to save their organs?
Right.
And these things are there all the time. And so what I ask people to do is to get involved, you know, to try to find out what's really happening.
Yeah.
And especially the young people. And people should not say, I want to be an organ donor. They should say no to that.
Right.
Believe me, there's great efforts to get the organs, and they will get them one way or the other. But when someone says yes, they give the license to the transplant surgeon to cut out their beating hearts. There's about 10 European countries that already have passed presumed consent to get their organs.
Right.
In the state of Delaware last year, they did introduce a bill that would have presumed consent, that it's presumed that you have consented to be an organ donor, and that would have been for everyone in the state of Delaware. Luckily, it did not get passed, but there will be attempts to do that. People ought not be involved in these things in medicine without being fully and explicitly informed. And with organ donation, organ transplantation, people need to be informed. They need to know that there is no way to get a heart for transplantation unless it's a beating heart.
Really? There is no such thing as a heart that isn't taken from a living person for a transplant.
That's correct.
Does that make organ transplantation immoral?
Well, immoral according to whose judgment? You see, it's not a question of morality anymore. What it is a question of law. You see, it's illegal to do it. The question of morality is past. Once you've legalized it, they've legalized the Uniform Determination of Death Act in the United States. They've legalized the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act and then revised it already in 40 states that it makes it legal to say that everyone intends to be an organ donor. That's the law. It's really a form of slavery. Involuntary servitude.
So this situation has gone beyond moral judgment or ethical decisions by the doctors involved. Even if they're personally opposed, the law would take over. And what you're asking people to do is get involved with the law as opposed to something shadowier.
Right. The laws are always the same, and I suspect that it's the same in Canada too. I'm not as familiar with it. I'm a little bit familiar because back when they were trying to pass the law, I did get all of the documents from Canada, and I did read those books, and I still have them in my file. But my memory says that it was in the 80s that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And my memory also says they were never able to come to a conclusion as to what their language was going to be. But they still behave in much the same way as they do in the United States, which is to get hearts for transplant. Now, you have to know that with the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, it has gone beyond getting organs from brain death. They don't wait for brain death anymore. And the patients who have clearly a functioning brain, but they want to get their organs, they do a test to predict how long their heart will beat after they take away the ventilator. And then they take away their ventilator, and they really don't wait till the heart stops beating. They wait till they can't record a pulse. And they wait for a shorter time than 75 seconds. That's 1.25 minutes. Two babies in Colorado last year, they waited 1.25 minutes, 75 seconds, and while the heart was still beating, but the babies were without a pulse, and that was a signal to cut the beating heart out of those babies and transplant them into other babies.
Oh, dear.
You know, it's no longer a matter of brain death. They now have this other thing called so-called cardiac death, but they don't wait till the heart stops beating.
Right.
They just wait until the heart can't beat strong enough to cause a pulse. And then that's the signal to cut out the beating heart.
I see.
At one time, they would wait, in some places they still do, they wait 5 minutes, some places 2 minutes. In Colorado, two babies, 1.25 minutes, 75 seconds, reported in the New England Journal of Medicine, August the 14th, 2008, where that's what they did to get the organs to transplant to other babies.
Is there something you'd like to say to wrap this up for people who are concerned? You've asked them to get involved.
Well,
you've told them how to get a card.
The most important thing that people have to do is, if they're so inclined to pray, I encourage them to pray.
All right.
No matter who or what they are, they need to be informed. They need to be informed. They need to speak up. They need to speak up to protect and preserve their own life, the life of their children, the life of their relatives, the life of their neighbors, their friends.
Right.
And they need to know that if they're comatose and unconscious, their life is in jeopardy because somebody wants their organs.
Oh, yeah.
And they're going to do everything they can to get their organs. And they get them through brain death, which is not death. And then what they call heart death, which really is not death either, and so it's a way of getting organs. But the rest of that mindset is that when people are in such a condition that it's persistent vegetative state, it's a matter of limiting their treatment or minimally unconscious, you would think that these things were being investigated, hopefully to get more treatment, but I'm not convinced that that will happen. I would wish and hope and pray that that would happen, but people who are unconscious and comatose, their life is in jeopardy, and people need to wake up and start to pay attention to these issues.
I appreciate you bringing that home on the show. It's an issue that I wasn't aware of in such depth until you spoke on it. Thanks, Dr. Byrne.
Thank you very much for having me. If people have questions, they can get in touch with us at www.lifeguardianfoundation.org. We will provide them. They can look on the Internet and get more information about these things. And we are there to provide information for people.
Right. Thanks again.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to Dr. Paul Byrne, a neonatologist who for 30 years has been studying brain death and talks to us about living wills, brain death, cardiac death, and other hazards of modern medical care. And now it's time for Disrespect's review of the news. Remember, these are not the stories themselves. These are condensations. And for the stories themselves, you should go to the newspaper articles that we try to identify on the show. First National Post, Saturday, February 6, 2010. Old Theory Put on Life Support by Tom Blackwell. The 10-month-old Edmonton boy had been left alone in his bathtub for only a few minutes. By the time a caregiver returned, however, the child was floating face down and motionless, drowned in a few inches of water. 42 hours later, doctors declared the baby brain dead. A frantic battery of treatments from CPR to drastic cooling of the child's body having failed to revive him. And yet that was not the end of the story. 15 hours after death was diagnosed at Stollery Children's Hospital, signs of life suddenly reappeared. People at the bedside noticed what they first thought were hiccups, recalled Dr. Ari Joff, the intensive care specialist summoned to investigate the unusual case. It was obvious the baby was making breathing efforts. The infant eventually died, but the earlier spontaneous breathing showed that some brain function had returned. In a recently published report, Dr. Joff says the case calls into question the very concept of brain death and whether it truly represents a person's permanent demise, adding fuel to a heated medical and philosophical debate over how to determine a life has ended. It used to be that someone was considered dead simply when their heart stopped beating. The concept of brain death, an irreversible loss of all brain function, emerged in the 1960s in answer to modern medical technology that could keep the heart and lungs functioning mechanically during treatment. With blood continuing to flow through the body, it also presented prime conditions for removing organs for transplant. After the Edmonton case, which occurred about a year ago but has only now been reported in the journal Pediatric Neurology, Dr. Joff and his colleagues unearthed several other similar cases worldwide of people declared brain dead, only to seemingly come alive again. Most died soon after, but one 60-year-old man in 1976 recovered fully, while a newborn had a good outcome, and two were left in permanent vegetative state, though alive. Dr. Joff rejects the original justification for the brain death idea that the brain is a master organ ensuring the body is an integrated mechanism and not just a collection of cells. Brain dead bodies kept alive on life support machines have been known to give birth, develop through puberty, fight infection, and heal wounds, he notes. My own view is that brain death is a dismal state. It is a very poor prognosis, but I don't think that it is death, he said. People, I think, want to be called dead when they really are dead. For me, it's important that we're honest and don't stretch the rules, because if we do, it's tempting to stretch them even further. Dr. Chip Doig, another Calgary intensive care physician and part of the forum that came up with the current guidelines, said he supports the brain death diagnosis and also has questions about the case study, but he welcomes the controversy around a topic Canadians have generally overlooked. If ARI is raising an issue that is stimulating public attention and public debate, that is a good thing, he said. And from Joanna Frickatich at The Spectator, ask for scans, says MS Pioneer, urges patients to ask for MRIs to check neck veins for blockages. MS patients are being told to seek MRI scans and treatment by an Italian doctor pioneering a radical and unproven theory that the disease is vascular. But it will be next to impossible to get the tests and surgery in Ontario, leaving thousands of patients vying for the 100 spots in a Hamilton study testing the theory. Dr. Paolo Zamboni urged doctors to be more open to his ideas during a media conference at St. Joseph's Hospital recently, his first North American appearance since his theory of chronic cerebrospinal venous insufficiency started gaining worldwide attention in the fall. If I should be a neurologist and read similar reports, the first thing I should do is to investigate the neck veins of my patients, said Dr. Zamboni. My suggestion is to investigate patients as soon as we can, not to simply criticize. He said the tests to find out if veins draining blood from the brain are blocked and the procedure to improve the blood flow are already known to be safe and effective and should be available to MS patients. However, the Ministry of Health made it clear yesterday it won't fund the scans or balloon angioplasty to treat it because it considers Zamboni's theory to be, quote, experimental, unquote. Canada has one of the highest rates of MS in the world. About 1 in 1,000 people have the disease, so doctors say scanning them would overwhelm the healthcare system. That leaves MS patients with only one option in Ontario, trying to get into the study being launched by St. Joseph's Healthcare, McMaster University, and Hamilton Health Sciences. It is putting in a proposal to the MS Society of Canada to scan the veins in the brains and neck of 100 MS patients with varying degrees of the disease and compare it to the veins of 100 similar healthy people. They're looking to see if the veins of people with MS are blocked, while healthy people's are not. The researchers have already had more than 22,000 MS patients from around the world try to get into the study. They are looking for other funders so they can test more people. Only the University of British Columbia is doing similar testing in Canada. 26-year-old single mom Jennifer Dennis, who lives in Whitby and is trying to get in the St. Joseph's study, pleaded with health professionals to no avail to use the study protocols when they did a regularly scheduled MRI in December. It's very frustrating, she said. Here is a potential medical breakthrough for a crippling disease, and they don't want to do it. It only takes one person to take the chance, but right now, no one is willing to take the chance. Dr. Mark Hack, who works out of both McMaster and Detroit, says he thinks Canada is missing out on the opportunity to create a national database of MRI scans on MS patients. My personal opinion is that patients should be getting these images, he said. Both Hack and Zamboni acknowledge more study needs to be done, although they say early research out of Poland and Jordan is backing up Zamboni's theory. The Buffalo Neuroimaging Analysis Center was expected to release the first results from its CCSVI study of 500 patients. The results were predicted to back up Zamboni, considering it is now moving forward from studying the MRI scans to testing the treatment. The preliminary results are exciting scientifically and will generate a great deal of discussion, stated the center's director Robert Zivadinov in a newsletter last week. This particular research is having an impact like no other we have known. And now a break with Joe Louis Walker, Prisoner of Misery.
Three times a fool, that's what I've been.
Natives, poor health tied to poverty, from the Hamilton Spectator. Higher rates of H1N1 hospitalizations and of deaths among Aboriginals compared to other Canadians demonstrate how basic human rights are not applied equally, according to First Nations physician Dr. Marcia Anderson. The Manitoba doctor told a gathering at McMaster University that the right to health is a basic human right that is also tied to a decent standard of living. If social, economic, and health policies were applied equally in Canada, there wouldn't be such large health gaps between First Nations and non-Aboriginals, she said. Aboriginals make up 3% of Canada's population, but accounted for 17% of H1N1 hospitalizations, 14% of intensive care cases, and 10% of deaths as of September, according to the Public Health Agency of Canada. Anderson was the keynote speaker at a seminar meant to increase knowledge and awareness of First Nations issues among health professionals. Anderson said the key social determinants of poor Aboriginal health are similar to the socioeconomic factors hurting the health of Canada's poor. It's not surprising to any of us that Aboriginal people have poor health, Anderson said. Aboriginals have shorter lifespans, higher suicide rates, and twice as many single-parent households compared with the rest of Canadians, she said. Aboriginal women also have higher rates of unemployment and less education and are more likely to be in the sex trade, incarcerated, and victims of violence than other Canadian women, she said. And 42.7% of Aboriginal women are in the low-income bracket compared with 20.3% of other women, while 1 in 4 First Nations kids live in poverty compared with 1 in 6 of all Canadian children. Our collective tolerance for injustices is really quite shocking, Anderson said. In order to address health inequities, we must address the inequities in the way society is organized. This session was organized by the university's Aboriginal Students Health Sciences Office, which assists Aboriginal Health Sciences students. Again, the Spectator, and again, Joanna Frickedich. The St. Peter's Day Hospital is cutting caregiver respite as it drastically changes the program that helps seniors living at home. For more than 30 years, the hospital's provided one-stop convenience for seniors, where they come twice a week for the day to get all of their medical care at once, including physiotherapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy. At the same time, they meet others with similar illnesses, share a meal, play games, and talk. Their caregivers get 2 days off a week and have access to social workers if they need support. That will come to an end by May when St. Peter's cuts all but the medical services at the day hospital. Seniors will come in for scheduled medical appointments only and leave when they're done. Donna Cripps, president of St. Peter's, said the driving factor behind the change is that the hospital can treat 20% more patients by changing the day hospital to appointments. Certainly, demand for geriatric services is growing, she said. Our response here is to provide increased accessibility to the service because that's what our community needs. Cripps said caregivers can get respite and senior socialization at a variety of other day programs offered in the city. However, those programs cost 3 times more per day and have waiting lists. St. Peter's costs $5.25 a day. Other day programs in Hamilton cost $15 to $18 a day. The average wait is 2 to 6 months. That could get worse as seniors who would normally go to St. Peter's try to get into the other day programs. The day hospital saw 10 to 12 patients a day and has a wait list of about 2 months. Patricia Crabtree, who has volunteered at the day hospital for 12 years, said its benefits go far beyond the medical care it provides. She said a lot of new patients who are hesitant to come at first don't want to leave by the time it's done. It's a happy little place, she said. It's a much-needed program. The change is going to be dramatic. And from letters to the editor in The Spectator, Sharon Russell in Hamilton, re-seniors. Trimming Macassa Seniors Program, reprehensible. My mother, 82, has been involved in the Seniors Day Program at Macassa Lodge for 2 years. This program provides supervised, individualized activities in a group setting, helping participants maintain their independence and enhancing their ability to continue to live in the community. It also provides respite and support to the primary caregiver when required. My mother has flourished in it. Canada has one of the highest rates of institutionalization in the world. This program allows seniors to remain in their homes and saves government money by delaying the admission to long-term care. Recently, program participants were advised by the city, which applied for funding and coordinates the program, that the program could no longer operate 7 days a week as the local health integration network will not fund the Saturday and Sunday program due to Macassar Lodge not meeting the target of 15 participants each day. I know there are many seniors who would benefit from this program, suggesting that communication promoting the program against the community agencies supporting the seniors has failed. This action is reprehensible, impacting our most vulnerable citizens who paved the way for our generation. From the National Post, by Kim Murphy. Vancouver wrestles with homelessness. Vancouver. Dawn Bergman was meticulous about preparing her shelter. When temperatures one December night in 2008 plummeted to 22 degrees, unusually frigid for Vancouver, she smoothed blankets and a tarp over the top of her large metal cart. Three times, police and outreach workers stopped by, summoned by reports of someone crying. Didn't she want them to take her to a shelter? No, she answered. Someone would steal her stuff if she left it unguarded on the sidewalk. She borrowed a lighter for her candles, which had gone out. The cop handed her a cigarette, too. "Quit waking me up," Bergman said. The next call came at 4:30 a.m. when someone reported seeing Bergman sitting upright in her cart, knees bent, arms at her sides, engulfed in flames. Her body was charred, her airway full of soot, her blood full of carbon monoxide, cocaine, and morphine, her soul long gone. At First United Church, after Bergman's death, the congregation decided to open the sanctuary 24 hours a day as a shelter that could accommodate about 300 homeless. Several rows of pews were cleared out to make way for beds. Sleeping bodies sprawl along the remaining benches. "We became an indoor park," Minister Rick Matthews said. In part to protest the billions of dollars being spent on the Vancouver Games, activists staged the Poverty Olympics in Vancouver, featuring events such as a wrestling match between community members and a character called Mr. Condo. "The kids ended up defeating the developer," said one of the organizers, Wendy Peterson. "That's the cathartic ending." The Pivot Legal Society is also distributing 500 red pop-up tents to be erected as living quarters for the homeless in prominent places throughout the city during the Olympics. But many out-of-towners may not get much of a feel for the downtown east side. A special car lane will whisk athletes and VIPs past a vista of bottle recycling centers and down-market sidewalk vendors. Visitors may also drive by the First United Church. Ellen Silvergater, director of advocacy services at St. Paul's Anglican Church, said one of her outreach workers encountered Dawn Bergman the night she died. "He tried to get her to go to a shelter. She had mental health problems. She had addiction problems. She should have had some housing with some supports in place," Silvergeiter said. "There wasn't any. And there still isn't." Montreal, the Canadian Press, from The Spectator. "Officer has no answer why teen shot in back." A Montreal police officer who killed a teenager and injured two others in a 2008 shooting says he has no idea why one of his victims was shot in the back. Jean-Luc Lapointe continued his testimony yesterday at a coroner's inquest into the shooting death of 18-year-old Freddie Villeneuve. He faced a series of difficult questions from Alain Arsenault, a lawyer representing Jeffrey Sager medalist who was hit in the back by a bullet from Lapointe's service weapon. Lapointe told the inquiry he was reacting to a mass of people who had cornered him as he tried to arrest Danny Villeneuve. And wrapping up the news, some nutritional advice you'll be glad to hear from The Independent. Bottoms up, beer's good for the bones. Researchers have news to make Super Bowl celebrations go down smoothly. Beer is good for you. A regular pint helps strengthen bones and prevent fractures in old age, so long as you don't drink too much of it and fall over. Beer is a significant source of silicon, which helps improve bone mineral density. The National Institutes of Health in the United States says silicon may be important for the growth and development of bones, and beer appears to be a major contributor to the amount of silicon in the diet. The best beers for silicon are the pale malted ales and lagers. Dark bitters and stouts contain lower levels because they're made with roasted barley, which has lower silicon content. Wheat contains less silicon than barley. Researchers from the Department of Food Science at the University of California have studied 100 commercial beers and found their silicon content ranged from 6.4 milligrams per liter to 56.5 milligrams. Paler beers have more silicon than darker ones because less heat is used in the malting process. The study published in the Journal of the Science of Food and Agriculture adds to the confusion over the benefits and drawbacks of booze. Most studies agree that people who drink some alcohol live longer than teetotalers. No word yet on chicken wings, however. And that's the news this week for Disrespect. Come back next week. There will be more.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.